Thanks, Lujin. Let me thank the organizers for letting the organizers to speak. So in my defense, it's justified because we're not the real organizer. The real organizer is Tiffany, as you heard from Giffrey this morning. This work is done together with these folks, Ashwin from Harvard, Yin Chen sitting here, and Xueyang Song, who's a student at Harvard. So over the past year or so, we've been developing a story that relates, quite nicely several different things in condensed matter physics. So the key player in this game is an exotic state in quantum magnetism in two dimension, known as U1 Dirac spin liquid. I'll say a little bit more what this really is in a few minutes, but roughly at low energy it's described by a field theory known as QED3, so a bunch of Dirac fermions coupled to an emergent dynamical U1 gauge field. Okay. So it's a very interesting phase on its own, but it turns out it's also related in an interesting way to many different competing symmetry breaking orders in 2D quantum magnetism, like the antiferromagnet, for example, on triangle lattice, the famous 120 degree order, or other types of order like valence bond solids and so on. Okay. So it turns out if you want to either understand this phase well, or if you want to understand the connection between this U1 Dirac spin liquid and these competing orders, what we need to understand is an object called monopoles, or also known as instantons, in this QED3 field theory. And also, it turns out to fully understand this instanton or monopole object, we need to use a tool developed in a different context known as band topology. And for the nerdier people, it's called SPT, symmetry protected topological phases. So aspects like topological insulators or even older concepts like one-ear centers or polarizations, they come in a somewhat surprising way. So that's the rough story. So now let me motivate you a little bit better why we care about this kind of thing. So quantum magnetism is a prototypical example of strongly correlated phase of matter, right? So let's focus on two dimension. Okay? Suppose I have 2D lattice with some, let's say, spin half sitting on each lattice site. Right. The Hamiltonian typically looks like this. So it's, you can put in Heisenberg and then add plus dot, dot, dot. Right. The dot, dot, dot sometimes is more important than the actual Heisenberg term. So 99% of the time, it's not solvable analytically. So sometimes the more tractable question is to ask what are possible phases of matter. Right. And then there are some simple symmetry breaking orders. That, we say it's simple, but already it's quite rich there. For example, you can have magnetic ordering, which breaks spin rotation symmetry, or you can have what we call valence bond solid ordering, which preserves the spin rotation symmetry but breaks the lattice symmetry in some funny way, right? And they look somewhat differently on depending on whether you are on bipartite lattices like square or honeycomb, or non-bipartite lattices like the triangle or Kagome. Right? And then you look at the complicated phase diagram, it's natural to ask, is there something more unifying? Right? So do I have to remember every single picture? Right? On bipartite lattice, that goal has more or less been achieved under the name of deconfined criticality, which you heard a little bit from Sento this morning. There we know how to write down a theory that sort of unifies these two seemingly very different symmetry breaking orders. Right? Then it's natural to ask, can we also do it on non-bipartite lattice? Yeah. So what that theory is going to look like? Well, there has been the proposal for quite a while. I think this paper was from 2004. Yeah. The proposal is that maybe something known as the Dirac spin liquid or U1 Dirac spin liquid can do the job. In terms of field theory, it looks like this. So it's some number of Dirac fermions. Usually we have two Dirac valleys and two Dirac spins. That couples to an emergent U1 gauge field. I'll say a little bit more where this field theory comes from in a minute. Right? But the proposal is that maybe this state does the job. Right? It was first proposed on square lattice, I believe. That's from the 2004. And then more recently, from Chao Ming and Chen Ke and their collaborators, it was also proposed as a theory that unifies many different competing orders on the triangle lattice. Okay? But one key issue that's still open for this for understanding this theory is, if I look at this theory, there is an object called monopoles. And I need to understand that to actually put the story on solid ground. Okay. Okay, so now let me give you a crash course on this story of U1 Dirac spin liquid. It's really motivated by question of, we have some strongly interacting spin model, so how do we ever hope to solve it analytically? Well, there is one way to, it's actually not solving it, but to construct interesting phases of matter known as the parton construction. So for this, for a spin half operator, you can decompose it into a bilinear, a product of two fermion operators that carry spin half. So this F fermion, they live on each side and they carry spin half. They are known as spinons, right? And then once you rewrite it this way, your Hamiltonian is going to look horrible. It's going to be some four fermion Hamiltonian on every possible bound and so on. But then you do the crazy thing, which turns out to be working for some time, is that you consider a mean field solution of this problem, which is basically solving a free fermion hopping problem. Okay. So that aspect captures the non-trivial entanglement between the spins, and sometimes leads to a handy recipe to access possible interesting states of matter. Right? So for those of you who are looking for solving an actual Hamiltonian like this, this recipe may or may not work in practice, but it's a good way to construct interesting phases. If the question is what are the possible interesting phases? So one particular interesting kind of mean field ansatz for the spinons, motivated partly historically by the Couperet story, but now I think we can talk about it on its own, is known as the Dirac spin liquid. So what to do is to arrange this hopping parameter T so that at low energy and long wavelength, my fermions form some Dirac cones. For example, on triangle lattice, this can be achieved by having some pi flux for every downward triangle and zero flux for every upward triangle, right? And at low energy, you get some Dirac dispersions like this. Okay. As I said, it's motivated from the RVB and Couperet story, but I guess one key message today is that this kind of Dirac spin liquid is interesting even if it doesn't solve Couperet for us. Okay, so but of course I will be lying if I say the strongly coupled spin Hamiltonian at the end of the day becomes just a free fermion hopping problem. That's lying, because it's actually a gauge theory in disguise, because there once I decompose, if you remember, my spin operator into this form, there is a gauge redundancy. I can redefine, for example, my fermion operator by a phase factor on every site, and nothing will change, right? So that's a U1 gauge redundancy. This means that if I go to low, if I want to have a low energy description of my theory, there will be an emergent dynamical U1 gauge field that couples to this fermion spinons. Okay, and in fact, the gauge coupling is such that, on the lattice, you can write down the F fermions that minimally couples to the gauge field. And the gauge charge will be defined as the fermion occupation minus one. The reason is that if I want to recover the spin half Hilbert space, I want to have one fermion per site. Right? That gives me a spin half on every site. Okay. So gauging variance requires this gauge charge, this occupation minus one, to be zero on average. So now I can try to write down my low energy continuum theory, right? I've told you that I arranged the hopping so that my spin-on forms some number of Dirac cones at low energy. It also has to couple to a U1 gauge field. It's a dynamical gauge theory. So what's the simplest continuum field theory I can write down? Well, it's this, right? It's called the QED3. So I have some number of Dirac cones. In this case, I have four two-component Dirac fermions. In low energy, it really there are two coming from the spin because this is spin half, and then two from the valley because without breaking time reversal on the lattice, I have to realize two Dirac cones. Yes.
Is there supposed to be a term that gives dynamics to the U?
Yes. There's a dynamical gauge field U1 gauge field little a, and in general I should include a Maxwell term. For the gauge field.
Does that arise from the Hamiltonian that you presented before?
If you like, it comes from RG, because you rewrite, okay, the standard way is to do this rewriting, put it back into your Hamiltonian, you get some horrible four fermion term, you do some mean field decoupling, but the amplitude has a gauge, the amplitude behaves like the gauge connection, and then you integral your higher energy fermion, you get an effective action for the gauge field. But you know, being able to take the continuum limit is actually far from trivial. But I'm glossing through that. Okay, so eventually it becomes some simple theory like this. Right? At least it looks simple, but until you actually try to solve it. Few words. So first of all, this is not the textbook QED in four dimension, in the sense that it's actually strongly coupled in the IR. The gauge coupling actually flows to, it doesn't flow to zero. Okay, so strictly speaking, we don't actually know what it does in the low energy. It could do something boring, meaning it could coupling becomes so strong that the symmetries get spontaneously broken. My Dirac fermions spontaneously generate a mass, and then I just get some free theory at the end of the day. Okay, that's a possible scenario. But a more interesting scenario would be that. It flows to a strongly coupled but still critical state, or a CFT. Okay? And in this scenario, there will be many interesting consequences. So that we want to explore. So let me first say that this scenario is partially supported by recent numerics from the lattice gauge theory community, at least when something called monopoles are ignored, which I'll come back to later. Okay? So. It's not definitive at this point, but let's assume that. And once you assume that, there are two nice consequences. One is that there will be an emergent SU4 spin valley symmetry, simply because when I write down this theory, I have four two-component Dirac cones. So in principle, I can implement an SU4 rotation on the Dirac fermions. Which microscopically, I don't have that. Microscopically, I have some SO3 spin rotation symmetry, but then some discrete lattice translation and rotation, that's it. Right? But this paper argued that if I actually flow to a non-trivial CFT, I have the full SU4. Also, I have another emergent U1 symmetry that corresponds to the conservation of the gauge flux. So whenever I have a U1 gauge field in two dimension, this U1 flux, the zero component is basically the B field, the magnetic field, is a conserved object. Okay? It's a conserved current. So that corresponds to an actual emergent U1 symmetry. So now let me come to the key object that I want to focus on for this talk. It's known as the monopole in QED3. Okay? So it's an object, it's an operator, if you like, that inserts a 2 pi flux of the dynamical U1 gauge field, little a. If you like, it's charged with a charge 1 under the under this U1 flux conservation symmetry. Okay, let me emphasize, we're talking about 2 plus 1D space-time. So a monopole looks like a point in space-time, unlike the more familiar 3 plus 1D story. So it's really a flux insertion operator, if you like. Okay? So in QED3, one special thing is that every time I have a monopole, my Dirac fermion will contribute a zero mode. Okay? So I have one zero mode per Dirac fermion. And gauge invariance requires that, so I won't go into the argument leading to this result, but just bear with me, that gauge invariance requires half of the Dirac zero modes to be filled, right? So you can imagine having a 2pi flux background, and then my Dirac fermion moving under the flux background, there will be some Fermi levels. So the ground state, you can imagine as you fill all the negative energy levels, make all the positive energy levels empty, but the zero modes, you know, whether you fill or not, doesn't change the energetics. Right? So there you have some choices to make. And then the rule is that you should fill half of the zero modes. In this case, we have four Dirac fermions, so that's four different zero modes to fill, and so you need to fill two of them. And simple combinatorics tells you you should fill, there are six different ways to fill this zero modes. Okay, so this represent the zero mode. And right, so and it turns out if you do the algebra a little bit more carefully, you realize that this six monopoles actually form a vector representation of the SL6 group, which is more or less the SU4 flavor rotation group. Okay? And in some sense, you should view this as the fundamental order parameters of this QED3 theory. Right? If I ask you, naively, if I ask you, what are the fundamental objects or fundamental operators in this QED3 theory, the naive answer is those psi fermion, but that's illegal because they're not gauge invariant. So the gauge invariant operators either come with a fermion bilinear like psi bar psi or the monopole operator. Okay?
But they also acquire some phase factor from the Fermi C, right?
Yes. Yes.
It'll change the nature of the order parameter, but it'll be
yes.
SO6 symmetric anyway?
That's my next slide. Okay. But let me just say the SO6 is only coming from the flavor part. So the full symmetry is actually more or less SO6 times U1. The U1 is the flux. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's a mod Z2, but let me not go into that. And then the Dirac C part is in the U1. So and just by looking at how the zero modes transform under the spin rotation symmetry, whether you know they form some triplet or spin singlet, you can convince yourself that three of the six monopoles behave like spin singlet, while the other three behave like spin triplets. So basically, three of them behave like some magnetic order, while the other three, at least they are spin singlet. Right? There may be some other symmetry breaking order. So now the problem that has been like open for quite a while is that how do these monopoles transform under the physical discrete symmetries like lattice translation or lattice rotation, right? Because on the lattice scale, we don't have the full SU4 or U1 symmetry. We have some pretty small group, SO3 cross some discrete stuff, right? So how does the monopole transform under those? Right. So in general, the monopole can transform this way. So this phi can under a symmetry action, can have some SO6 flavor rotation. But that's like an SU4 flavor rotation. Okay. So that's decided by how the Dirac fermions transform under the different lattice symmetries or spin rotation symmetries. And that's relatively easy to decide. We more or less know what to do there. And by the way, that if you put it in this form, that's basically determined by how the fermion zero mode transform under the physical symmetries. But as Subir just pointed out, there's also an entire field Dirac C underneath, and the Dirac C may not transform entirely trivially under a physical symmetry, so it may contribute something extra, and that's the overall U1 phase factor. So this part, you can view it as the Berry phase for the monopole when it moves in this background of Dirac C. Right? For example, if I lattice translate the monopole by a unit, the Dirac C is going to rearrange, and at the end of the day, it may split out a Berry phase to me. So how do I determine that? Right? And that's been somewhat hard to decide. It's certainly harder than the flavor rotation part, because it doesn't just come from the IR. The flavor rotation part is basically IR physics. Once I write down my Lagrangian, I more or less know what to do. But this Berry phase is different. So it's it has a lattice scale origin. Right? It's a Berry phase accumulated by the monopole when you move in this lattice charged background. Okay. And in the context of Dirac spin liquid, you know, there's some partial progress on this problem, dating from Jason Alicia's paper in 2008. That relies on numerics, essentially. Right? But then analytically, how do we decide it, and what, you know, conceptually, what really gives this this Berry phase factor? Has been the open issue. Okay. So that's the issue we're going to resolve and understand the phase. But before I tell you the result and how we do it, let me say a little bit more why we care about this problem, right? So monopole is some funny object in that QED3. You know, if we don't understand it, what's the big deal? Well, there's the conceptual aspect, which is it's a fundamental operator in the theory. So we better understand it. We better know how to characterize it. More practically, there are three aspects. One is the behavior of the monopole under the symmetry action actually determines how stable my U1 Dirac spin liquid really is. Right? Because if the monopole is transforms trivially under all the physical symmetries, then it's allowed to be added to my Lagrangian as a perturbation. And from various estimation, this perturbation is going to be relevant and drives me away from this QED3 fixed point. Most likely, it's going to destroy my spin liquid. Probably gives you a confined symmetry breaking state. Okay. And also, in case where this doesn't happen, in case where the monopoles are not allowed as a perturbation, and I get a stable fixed point, the monopoles are still local operators. Relevant local operators in the theory that will show up in various measurement. For example, if it carries a non-trivial momentum, lattice momentum, then it will show up somewhere in the spectroscopy. Let's say, for example, when you do neutron scattering. Okay. I had the 3 and 2 permuted. All right. Also, even when the spin liquid is not stable at the end of the day, the behavior of the monopole actually determines exactly what kind of symmetry breaking order I end up getting, right? If I perturb away from the spin liquid. And that's more or less because the monopoles are the natural order parameters in my theory. So, of course, how my order parameter transform under the under all the symmetries will matter a lot. Okay? So that's the motivation. So here's a summary of the result. So I'll go into some detailed aspect a little bit soon. But let me tell you the overall result. The overall result is that, first of all, the monopole behaves very differently on bipartite versus non-bipartite lattices. So it turns out on bipartite lattice, there is always a monopole that transforms trivially under all the lattice symmetries. Translation, rotation, spin rotation, time reversal, and so on. And therefore, it's, you know, even if I try to realize a QED3 Dirac spin liquid, the monopole is going to come in as a relevant perturbation and destroy the spin liquid. So I don't expect the Dirac spin liquid to be actually a stable phase on a bipartite lattice. At best, we probably get something like deconfined criticality. And that's actually consistent with numerics in the sense that nobody actually found anything like a Dirac spin liquid on bipartite lattice so far. On the other hand, on non-bipartite lattice, it turns out at least the most relevant monopoles are always symmetry forbidden. So you try to cook up the most relevant monopole, it always transforms non-trivially under some of the symmetry group. Right? So then those monopoles are forbidden as perturbation. and we have a much better chance of realizing the QED3 Dirac spin liquid as a stable critical phase.
What is the flux of the smallest allowed monomer?
So that depends. So on triangular, it's going to be 6 pi, the threefold. On Kagame, it's going to be 4 pi. Right, the 4 pi monopole is a bit tricky because from large n, the scaling dimension is something like 2.5. So there's some room of negotiation there. On triangle, it's better. And furthermore, if I start from this this Dirac spin liquid and I perturb away from the critical point, from the critical phase, let's say I open up a mass for my Dirac fermion, then I get some then it flows to some more conventional symmetry breaking orders. For example, it can flow to the famous 120 degree order on a triangle lattice, or some crazier valence bond solid state. I think that each shape here represents a spin singlet. And so you don't break the spin rotation symmetry, but you break the lattice symmetry. And the enlarged unit cell has, I think, 12 sites in this case. So it's some funny state. Okay. Right. So basically we get a unified picture of many different symmetry breaking orders here. So let me just show you how that works with one simple example. Yes?
For the bipartite lattice, you said there is a monopole which is neutral under order symmetry.
Yes.
Does that suggest a featureless gap phase?
No, it actually doesn't. Probably in the language you're comfortable with, turning on a single monopole doesn't eliminate the anomaly. You have to turn on two to eliminate the anomaly. So you still need to flow to some symmetry breaking or something. Yes.
So how much of the statement on the previous slide depends on the particular pattern construction?
Right. So the fact that you're connected to this funny symmetry breaking order, that depends on the particular pattern construction. Right. So one can imagine. So these statements are for the simplest kind of partons mean field that can give you Dirac spin liquid. Right. One can imagine having some very different quantum construction that give you the similar U1 QED3 field theory, but with very different symmetry breaking orders, right? But for the bipartite non-bipartite statement, that mainly depend on the special thing about bipartite is the fact that you can upgrade the U1 gauge symmetry to an SU2 1. Right. So in that sense, it depends less strongly on the exact pattern construction. So, but it still depends somewhat. Right. Yeah. Okay. So now let me show you roughly how that works. Just with the one simple but interesting example. So let me focus now on the triangle lattice. Right. So on a triangle lattice, as I mentioned, you can get this Dirac dispersion with some pi flux in the upper triangle lattice, something like that. But now we can imagine breaking some symmetry and add a particular mass term to the Dirac fermion. In particular, I want to add this kind of mass term. So sigma is a Pauli matrix acting on the spin index. Right? So in the condensed matter literature, this is known as a quantum spin Hall mass. But now I'm doing the triangle lattice. Okay, so this breaks spin rotation symmetry because I have a sigma z here, but it breaks no lattice symmetry, right? And it doesn't break time reversal as well. Yes.
So what kind of state that is? If you just had that mass term, I mean, it's a quantum spin Hall state. Is that right?
Yeah. If you only look at the fermions, it's just a quantum spin Hall.
It's a chiral spin liquid.
No, it's not. No, this is sigma z. It's not a Chern mass. Oh, it's a K-Malay mass. It's the triangular version of K-Malay.
But there's no spin orbit. I mean, it's some kind of spontaneous spin orbit coupling. Is that right?
Yeah, if you like. Yeah, yeah. Well, if you want to realize with this with a spin ordering, you just look at what symmetry you need to break. You need to break spin rotation down to U1.
Yeah.
So you break SO3 down to SO2. and keep all the other symmetries. So it's actually somewhat non-trivial. You can't just add an anisotropy, because anisotropy will break SO3 down to O2. You want to break down to SO2, so you want to break this spin flip symmetry as well. So you need to put in some, for example, complex S plus S minus hopping on the bonds and so on. So
you're doing this as a calculational trick?
Sorry?
You're adding this term as a calculation.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, it's just a calculation trick.
Is this the moment? Dilution scheme will be a type term.
Yeah, I guess I'm just describing DM in a complicated way, but yeah.
Spontaneously generates, just imagine that.
Yeah. Well, you can put it in explicitly if you want.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So now everything is in a gap phase.
Now the spin-ons are gapped. I haven't said what happens to the gauge field yet.
Yeah. This gap, would it be just trivial? Would it be just confining? Oh, but now you're examining a quantum number.
Yeah, I'm exactly asking the question, what is the confined phase? Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, this gets simplified. This simplifies things a lot. Well, first of all, the fermions are gapped. They no longer give you critical fluctuation. Things are pretty simple. Also, the fact that also the monopoles are no longer degenerate. Before, I had 6 degenerate monopoles. You know, they have some SO6. Vector structure and so on. But now there's a unique monopole that's get picked up. If you think about the zero modes, right, having this term is like saying all the zero modes with spin up have negative energy and all the zero modes with spin down have positive energy. So now it's clear what zero modes I should feel. I should feel the 2 zero modes with spin up, one at left valley and one at right valley. Okay. Right, so now there's only one monopole. And also, just by looking at the way the zero modes are filled, you see that this carries spin the SZ quantum number plus 1, right? Because it's up. Okay. And something that carries SZ equal to plus 1, you know, looks like SX plus ISY. Right? That's how this operator behaves under symmetry. So it looks like a non-collinear magnetic order already. Right? So since I'm on a triangle lattice, I have a non-collinear magnetic order, it's tempting to say that I'm pretty much getting a 120-degree order. Right? But of course, to fully establish that, I have to understand how this order parameter, aka my monopole, transforms under my lattice symmetries. Right? This particular 120 order has a specific way of implementing the lattice translation and rotation, right? Whether I get that on a monopole. So that's the question I need to
What about the original mass term? Do you have to worry about that?
Yeah, so this term breaks spin rotation, but not lattice. So when I think about the lattice symmetry, I don't have to worry about this term.
There's some residual Jaluzinski-Maria coupling left over. Won't that affect the final symmetry transformations? Or just assume that's infinitesimal or something.
No, actually, for the later part, I'm going to assume this mass is infinite. So, the statement is all this lattice symmetry behavior will go into the monopole. Right? The fermion don't see any lattice symmetry breaking. But they, as you said, you're right, that they come with some non-trivial phase factors here and there.
Just in the kind of the intertwining, so to speak, of lattice and spin symmetry.
Yeah.
And that it does do that.
Yeah. So here's the calculational recipe. The trick is to, okay, so I have some quantum spin hole insulator that looks somewhat complicated. But the goal is to actually trivialize this insulator, to deform it adiabatically to something as trivial as possible, right? The important thing is, since we're looking for some discrete answer, for example, how the monopole transform under certain C3 lattice rotation symmetry, the answer is discrete. It's going to be a phase factor of either 1 or e to the I 2 pi over 3. So that's not going to change as I adiabatically deform my spin Hamiltonian. So let me do that. And then let me also ask, what's the most trivial insulator ever, right? The most trivial insulator is just atomic insulator, where I have just literally some local orbits with one fermion field at each orbit. Right? So let's do that. Let's deform this gap fermion to an atomic limit. And then I just represent the insulator as some field size, literally. Okay? Well, I can't quite do that if I preserve things like SZ rotation symmetry and time reversal symmetry, because this is a quantum spin hole. It's a topological insulator. By definition, it cannot have such an atomic limit. But now I'm asking about how my monopole transformed under lattice symmetry. Right? I'm no longer interested in SZ, the spin rotation symmetry, because I've already understood that. So let's break those symmetries. Let's break spin SZ rotation. Let's break time reversal. Break all the internal symmetries, but keep all the lattice symmetry. Right? And then it's no longer a TI. There's no obstruction in principle for me to deform it to a trivial limit. Right? So then let's do that. So there is a recipe from band theory developed in the past couple of years by Ashwin and Adrian Paul and Haruki Watanabe, also by Mike, to do that. But let me show you the result first. Right? So the result is this. So this quantum spin hole insulator on triangle lattice, if you break the SZ and time reversal, can be deformed into this thing. One particle per site on the triangle lattice, but then one particle at each center of the upward triangle, but then one hole, or minus one particle at the center of each downward triangle. Okay. Now, if I count the gauge charge, remember on each site there is a background minus one gauge charge. That's just that just come from the requirement that on average I should have one particle per site. Right? So if I count the gauge charge, on each site, the gauge charge is zero because it's one minus one. But then on each upward triangle center, it's plus one. On downward triangle center, it's minus one. Okay, so that's the pattern of gauge charge. And now it becomes a quite simple task to ask about how my monopoles transform under lattice rotation symmetry. For example, if I rotate around an upward triangle center by 120 degree, then the monopole behaving as a 2 pi flux, sees this plus one gauge charge as a 2 pi flux, basically. So if I do a full rotation, it's going to pick up a phase of 2 pi. So each C3 rotation is going to give me 2 pi over 3 phase factor. So this is how my monopole transform under the C3 around the upward triangle center. Okay? Yes?
So this argument is very important, whether it's plus 2 pi or minus 2 pi.
Yes.
Because you're going to take the cube root of it.
Yes.
So how do you decide? The argument you gave, it's not clear whether you should assign plus 2 pi or minus 2 pi.
No, as long as I know whether it's E times M. Right.
So the sign of E and M fixes the...
Yeah. I mean, there are more formal ways to say it, but yeah. Now, if you allow me to gauge rotation symmetry, that they can be more precise, but let me not do that. And then likewise, for each downward triangle center, there's a minus one gauge charge. So the monopole, when moving around it, picks up a minus 2 pi over 3 whenever I rotate by 120 degree. Okay. So once I understand that.
The monopoles, where are they located?
Imagine it's somewhere away from this point. Exactly where, it doesn't matter, because the gauge charge it sees will be minus 1 plus 3n. Right? For example, if it's right here, it sees this 3 gauge charge, but that doesn't matter. Anything that's 3n doesn't contribute to the final answer. Of course, if the monopole is right here, you need to adjust the argument a little bit, but shouldn't matter. So once I understand this rotation, this two different rotation, then translation comes automatically. Because if I want to think about a translation, let's say in the x direction, that I can get from a 120 degree rotation around the downward triangle center, and then followed by a minus 120 degree rotation around the upward triangle center. You can just imagine. But then you look at the phase factor for this combination, it's 2 pi over 3. So the upshot is, if I understand all rotation, I understand translation. And then you look at this three transformation, then you realize that's exactly what you want for this famous 120 degree order on a triangle lattice. Okay, every triangle center rotation rotates the spin by some 2 pi over 3 or minus 2 pi over 3. Okay. So that's the trick. And one aspect I didn't quite explain is what this minus 1 actually means. After all, I promise you that I'll deform this insulator to one that's just literally filling some local orbits. But what does minus 1 orbit means? Well, that has been clarified in the band topology literature. It's a concept known as fragile topology. So it's in this paper. So the idea is that I lied a little bit when I said my insulator can be deformed to a trivial product state or trivial atomic insulator. It can't. But if I supplement the quantum spin Hall insulator with another atomic insulator without exactly one particle sitting at each downward triangle center, then I can deform the whole thing into an insulator with one particle per site and one particle per upward triangle. Okay. So essentially, what this picture really means is that if I add one particle here, then I can deform the thing to everything, one particle on site and one particle on upward triangle center. And then there's a band theory crank to figuring all that out. But
so these extra particles you're adding and removing are gauge neutral or no?
They're not. But the final result, the total gauge charge should be zero. This cancels with this, and then you, on average, you have one particle per site. Yeah.
The same as thinking of there just being a Vanier product in pools.
Yeah. It's equivalent to that. Yeah.
So in terms of the microscopic original lattice fermions, is there some way to think about these extra fermions or that you're adding and moving?
If you stick with the original fermion, the thing is you can't quite deform it to this atomic like thing, right? But the idea is, so this this fragile topology, you can view it as a trick. For example, the original fermion should have an answer for what the monopole does under symmetry, right? But then we don't know how to figure that out. But then we add a layer of this thing on top, and then we can figure out how the monopole transforms, and then we subtract off.
Right? Really speaking, the original degree of freedom would be start with two fermions on the triangular sites, and then make a Vanier orbital, which is a superposition around a triangle, and then make holes of that acting on.
Yeah. So if you bring in more fermion operators, yeah. So
for the original fermion, there was a constraint, right? So
yeah.
With the initial fermion you're adding, you don't need the constraint?
No, you still have the constraint is saying on average you should be gauge neutral. The gauge charge in total should be zero, right? So in a way it is, okay. If you have literally this, you're violating that constraint. Yes. But then at the end of the day, for your answer, you subtract that off.
Right? What do you mean you have to subtract it off?
No. I'm saying to figure out how the monopole transforms, yeah. Let's say under a lattice rotation, you don't have to stick with the constraint. Yeah, you need your final answer to be consistent with that constraint. But to just know to get an answer for the monopole, you don't. Right. So you can get an answer for the monopole, let's say for this insulator, even though it violates your constraint. It has more, it has positive charge per unit cell. Right? But then you subtract. At the end of the day, you subtract off this part. So the final result is consistent with the gauge constraint.
Yeah. It's not obvious to me, but maybe.
Yeah, I can explain a little more in more detail. Yeah. All right. So this statement can be checked numerically. You just put the Dirac fermion on a quantum spin Hall insulator, choose one, on a torus, and then put a 2 pi total flux, let's say 2 pi over L square flux per plaquette, and then calculate the many-body momentum of your many-body wave function, and you get the answer of 2 pi over 3 on the triangle lattice. Yes?
So the This particular atomic insulator came from the quantum spin Hall mass.
Yes.
Can you show it doesn't matter what mass you put in all these?
No. Actually, I deliberately chose the quantum spin Hall mass because it's the easiest one. For example, you can choose a valley mass. It will look very different. And that's supposed to be like that, because if I choose a valley mass, the picture I get will be totally different.
Is that because it's picking a different monopole as lowest energy?
Yes. So if I do that, actually, I end up with something like this. So it's a different momentum, different angle momentum.
If you have two masses which pick out the same lowest monopole.
Oh yeah, then they should be the same. But the thing is, if you have different band topology, then to go from one to the other, you necessarily encounter transition, which from the monopole point of view, you're actually switching which monopole you pick up. So yeah. Right, so let me just have 1 minute discussion on what all this means. The interesting thing is, actually on both triangle ladders and Kagome ladders, there are some signs evidence from the numerical simulations that the U1 Dirac spin liquid actually are there in some reasonable spin Hamiltonian. On Kagome ladders, there are quite a few simulations indicating that even for the simplest nearest neighbor Heisenberg antiferromagnetic interaction, the Dirac spin liquid might be the actual ground state. And on triangle ladders, it's a little bit more complicated because for the simplest nearest neighbor Heisenberg antiferromagnet, the ground state is the famous 120 degree order. But if you crank up a next neighbor, J2, just by a little bit, the 120 order got destroyed. The thing becomes something that looks like a spin liquid, a gapless spin liquid. So phenomenologically, it's actually consistent with this being a U1 Dirac spin liquid, because first it's near a 120 degree order, which appears naturally in the U1 Dirac spin liquid. Another thing is, if I break time reversal and add, for example, a spin chirality term, then the Dirac spin liquid can get a churn mass, a quantum spin, quantum Hall mass, and that gives you a chiral spin liquid. And indeed, numerically, people found that a chiral spin liquid gets stabilized pretty much immediately after I break time reversal symmetry. Similarly on Kagome, I think. Also, when this Dirac spin liquid is stable, the monopole actually gives you some interesting signature. So in the spin liquid phase, for example, on the triangle lattice, I just showed that there is a class of monopoles. Now they behave as critical fluctuations, but they still carry the momentum 2 pi over 3. So they sit at the zone corners, the KK prime point of the Brillouin zone. And the prediction is that if I do, let's say, neutron scattering or numerical neutron scattering, then I should get some non-trivial spectral weight at the KK prime points. So that has to be understood from the monopole point of view. If I just look at the spin-on and so on, I don't see that. And recently, numerically, that's been observed in this paper, I think using variational Monte Carlo in some J1, J2 model. And also, there's an unpublished work from Yin Chen using DMRG that sees that. And with that, let me just conclude. And so thank you.
Some short burning questions?
Super.
In your last transparency, which has been seen, the one, the
this.
Circles or that one?
This.
What are the closer?
Yeah, these are spin singlets.
The VBS orders.
These are VBS orders. So it's not seen in this paper. I think Inchen saw this.
Saw that.
Oh, you only saw this? Okay.
Well, that's just the 120 degree state.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is, numerically, you can make sure that it's not at 120 degree order, but it has this fluctuation. Yeah. The thing is, you don't see that from spin-on. From the spin-on, you only see some spectral weight at these end points because the Dirac cones differ by.
We say both those K monopole and also the Fermi-Meyer.
Yeah.
That cannot be 120 degrees.
Yeah.